Welcome to another edition of Engineering Influence, a podcast from the American Council of Engineering Companies. And today, we are very happy to be putting a spotlight on our initiatives surrounding diversity and inclusion, which is something that is not only part of our strategic plan, but also something that has become a strategic focal point for many firms in the engineering and design industry. It's just a reflection of changing demands, both not only on the client side, but also on the firm side with their employees. The understanding of a greater diversity of individuals who are working at firms, bringing up ideas and answers to challenges, generally results in a better product at the end of the day. And having a more diverse workforce enhances the ability for firms to compete in a very competitive private marketplace for work. To kind of formalize our work on this area, our wonderfully talented and hardworking business and resources and education team put together a multi-module course for the first time that was focused on D&I, and it was called Strategies for Developing a Respectful, Diverse, and Inclusive Workplace Culture. And we put this up at the end of last year, and you know, we weren't really sure how it was going to be received. We were hopeful. We knew there was a lot of interest, and the course sold out. And subsequently put together a second session of the course, and it sold out. And we're hoping to put together a third coming up soon. And we're joined today by three participants in that first course. We have with us Krista Luza. She is the associate principal and a structural engineer as well with Bueller. We have Susan Ouellette. She's the director of HR at Klein & Schmidt. And we have Gary Brennan, who is the president of Bros Engineering out of North Dakota. Really want to start off with Krista. What attracted you to the course, and what did you hope to get out of it when you first signed up?
Thanks, Jeff. At the time when I saw the course come through, excuse me, we had been talking internally about, you know, our diversity practices as it relates to promotions and salary surveys, and just starting to scratch the surface on how do we evaluate those things. Structural engineering is an industry that is typically male dominated and also white male dominated. And so, you know, we can only deal with what we're given, you know, the people that apply, the people that come out of college. But as a firm, we were just starting to look about, you know, the office and how do we open up the conversation and how do we get started and what are the issues? And so myself, our president, and our HR director all participated in the course in an effort to open our minds and stretch our thinking and then talk about it internally from those three different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. So this presented a good way to get a little bit more of a structural or a structured view of D&I efforts in the workplace.
Exactly. Yeah. We, you know, we all definitely learned a lot during the process, just things that we had never even concerned ourselves with before, even thought were issues before. And we started to really understand and evaluate them after coming through the course.
And Susan, along those lines, I mean, coming in as a director of HR, I mean, your perspective is on people management and workplace. You know, bringing that perspective into the course, you know, what did you hope, you know, you could learn or the discussions that you would have in that class, you know, with some people who are either in management, maybe not HR professionals themselves, maybe they're engineers or they're in the management track. You know, what did you want to contribute to the conversation?
Well, we have been on the path with a few efforts of our own internally to, you know, broaden the net, if you will, for our recruitment efforts and to do just as you spoke about, Jeff, earlier, is to, you know, bring a diversity of minds and thinking and people to the organization so that we can, you know, just be the best we can be. And in this industry, that's very challenging with just typical standard recruitment processes. So it's also was written in our strategic plan. We had a strategic plan initiative in September. This notice came And I'm like, I'm in it. I'm a white woman from Central Maine. I do not have a big background in working with people of different ethnicity and culture. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to be part of encouraging and supporting the kind of culture environment that we embrace at Kleinschmidt, I need to get educated a bit. Mm-hmm. It's not that I haven't been. I was a school teacher before I did this work. And you know, humans are humans. And so, you know, this course was really well done. And the pieces that were the most surprising to me, that probably have some of the most significant impact, is the unconscious bias that we all possess. And, you know, and it's not an intentional thing, it's unconscious. And how you navigate that and create awareness there. And then the bystander intervention module was just totally surprising and so interesting how, you know, how your culture, how you develop your culture really impacts how people will respond to someone, you know, not being treated equitably or, you know, just. And so that was a real eye opener for me. But really, it was about getting as much of this under my belt as possible so that we can, you know, move this initiative forward. We've created a new committee called JEDI, Justice, Equity, Diversion, and Inclusion. And then I probably sat in on 3 or 4 different sessions like this in my different professional associations over the last few months.
That's great. And Gary, I want to get your perspective because, I mean, you're a principal of the firm. I mean, you're president of Bros Engineering. You're taking part in this class shows leadership in its own. From your position at the firm, you know, why did you sign up and, you know, what did you hope to really just walk away from the course?
Yeah, I guess my primary reason that I was interested in it is our company's grown a lot in the last couple of years. We're a mid-sized firm. We're located in the upper Midwest, primarily in the Dakotas. And we just capped over 100 people, 100 employees in the organization. We were probably, rewinding to 3 years ago, probably 70 FTEs. So we've grown a lot in a matter of a short amount of time. And just felt like maybe we were lacking or falling behind in some of our HR initiatives. It was something more out of interest, curiosity, if you will, whatever. I wanted to hear what some of the dialogue was, more of a self-education or self-awareness component, if you will. You know, I've been in this position for just a year, started as president in January of 2020, just in time to inherit COVID.
Congratulations.
Different story.
Other challenges there.
Yeah. But really, I guess at the end of the day is just human resources, having a larger emphasis on that in that department, whatever the course is last year, has allowed me to realize that, hey, there's some education that I need. You know, like our HR people can be up to speed and educated all they want, but I don't understand the lingo unless I'm educated myself. So that's why I sat in the class. And
yeah.
And I guess just to kind of echo or take on what Susan said, I think the biggest thing for me was the awareness component that came forward with the unconscious bias that, I guess maybe you knew it was there, but kind of brought it out in the forefront a little bit more after having sat through this class. So, but for me, it was just more awareness, I guess, whatever the topic.
Have you all noticed on the client side a greater demand for, maybe not explicitly, but a trend towards having client teams that are more representative of the population? That there's a demand for a greater diversity of a team that's either pitching the business or directly engaged with it?
Yeah, I would like to jump on that one. We actually had a very explicit experience where for many years, we've always assumed and approached projects with throw experience at it. We have a really deep bench of experience in our company. So get the person with the most number of years and the most experience in that sector and, you know, send them on their way to go tackle that project pursuit. About a year or two ago, we did just that. We lined up our CEO, you know, 40 years experience and a couple of other folks with long resumes and went into a project interview, did not win the project and got very clear feedback that our company represented older white men, right? And the panel was a very diverse panel. And so we went into that project pursuit with the wrong approach. And we have diversity. We have, you know, all the things that they were looking for, but we missed the mark and we missed it big. And that was a very big learning opportunity for us.
And that's a really good example, because you go in, you're like, okay, we got this. We have the most experience. We got good demonstrated prior experience. You know, it's a good, you know, portfolio of work we put together, and it's a good proposal. And then all of a sudden something like that happens. I mean, that's a cultural shock in its own, because you have to rethink the way that you're approaching business development. I guess that leads me to a question that I'm wondering, you know, and really is up for anyone. You know, how far within your organizational structures has the conversation penetrated? You know, has it gone beyond, you know, HR? I think, Krista, for your experience, I think that was a very bright light on the BD side of the world. But has it penetrated throughout all sectors of the firm, or is it still kind of being talked about by the executive leadership teams and maybe just the HR departments, or has it gotten out to everyone?
I guess I can answer that one, Jeff, whatever. Yeah. Like, we probably haven't taken that initiative yet. And it's part of the reason why I was wanting to be on this training, whatever, just to find out more about it. Because I think that's important to do that, you know, because of we're in the middle of COVID yet and trying to crawl back out of that. We haven't had the same opportunity to launch it, I guess, in the way that it would like, because sometimes, whatever, some meetings, there's a little bit more value when they're bringing somebody, whatever, a speaker in to an in-person audience to try to really get more of a hands-on approach to providing training, whatever, about this topic. Mm-hmm. And I think there's definitely need for that as the look across to our organization to, again, just the awareness component, make people aware of the unconscious bias out there that maybe they weren't previously knew even existed. So I guess short answer is we haven't embarked on that yet, but there's definitely a recognized need for training, and that's kind of where our next step is.
I'd like to comment on that, mm-hmm. Jeff, as well. You know, our CEO is leading the JEDI committee, the diversity committee, along with one of my HR staff, one of my new hires that's really passionate about this work. And we have the chair of the board is on the committee, and a couple of managers, and then folks representing some diverse background. What I want to say is this isn't HR's project. HR is involved and has had exposure because we're the ones doing the EEO reporting. We're the ones, you know, keeping the affirmative action plans updated. We're the ones doing the recruitment. But this is not an HR project, and that's why I stepped away from the committee, so that it would really be a grassroots, top-led effort at a strategic level, and not be viewed as HR, but be viewed as an organizational effort that we're all part of and all responsible for helping to create. And I just wanted to make that mm-hmm. differentiation for us.
And Krista, how's it, you know, being seen at Bueller?
I think we're kind of more on Gary's side of things, where, you know, we're kind of just getting started. But I will say it's definitely being pushed forward by folks like myself. I'm a structural engineer. Our president, who's a structural engineer, mm-hmm. and interestingly enough, more of our younger staff coming out of college are more interested in these topics, right? So when you go to other webinars and seminars, they show up. They're not talking about it in the office, but I see them at mm-hmm. at the DEI webinars, right? So that's interesting.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of pushback. I've spoken with some of our more senior engineers that are like, oh, we don't want to open that conversation. You know, they're hesitant, they're scared. They just want to have leadership deal with it. So we're trying to figure out how to get over those hurdles, how to open the conversations and make people comfortable. So we're very early. We're in the beginning to getting those conversations going.
Yeah, I think you're in the same position as many of our member firms that are tackling this and trying to figure out how to approach it. And that's one of the reasons I think this course is important, because it at least gives you an opening or a handhold to at least get into the conversation. But that does bring in the idea of, and I think, you know, Gary, just you kind of hit on this earlier, and you know, showing that you have leadership buy-in. Do you think that having that leadership buy-in at the top provides enough air cover for people to feel more comfortable bringing these conversations up, and having that executive commitment to D&I programs does make it, it's never a comfortable conversation, but makes it a little bit more comfortable for junior staff or even, you know, some senior staff to broach these topics?
Yeah, I guess if I was to answer that question, I have an open doors policy as far as that goes. Anybody can come to my office if I don't have an appointment or otherwise tied up. They can walk in and talk to me about anything. I'd like to think whatever that we try to foster an atmosphere of being approachable, if you will, you know what I mean? Although some people still maybe aren't always comfortable talking about different topics. But I think trying to set that as a culture initially, whatever is being approachable, being able to talk about certain items, whatever, and having an open discussion about it is a good starting point. Will I say that it's really easy to have those conversations when you haven't had a lot of them in the past or none of them in the past? Probably not. You know, we're, like I talked about in the infancy stages, but I think it's trying to plan an initiative to start that. And like you said, it was led from the top down. I think at least people are more open to talking about it and may allow themselves to be more vulnerable, if you will, when those conversations do come up.
Yeah.
I think one of the key things is transparency.
Yeah.
You know, that Gary describes, and having that open door and understanding that there are just so many of us in our firms that are uncomfortable, but it's okay to be uncomfortable. You know, we're going to learn from each other and we're going to get better.
Mm-hmm. As long as you have that, I guess it's that overriding objective of saying the reason why we're doing this is because we want to improve firm success. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even from our perspective, coming in from it, from the association space, I mean, it's not something that historically we've talked a lot about. And we're trying to figure out, how do we navigate this with our member firms, that we have our larger, you know, multinational companies that have these robust programs and they're very progressive on it, to other firms that are traditionally a little bit more conservative. They don't want to stay, you know, this is outside of their lane. They're either mechanical or structural engineers. This is what they do. And they don't want to get engaged in this debate. It seems like that business case is what's the overriding kind of air cover for it. It's that you can prove, and we've had, you know, conversations before with some consultants, that just based off of research, that the firms that actually invest and work on D&I programs generally have greater revenues than the firms that don't, that it is a question of the marketplace and meeting the marketplace. Have you noticed that using that business case has made it a little bit easier to have those conversations?
Well, like Krista, you know, we're seeing an awful lot. I'm not up close to the project teams and the interview panels and all, but we are really seeing a lot of requirements in the RFP responses about the programs and what we're doing and how, what things we've done already, and how do we demonstrate, you know, an open, equitable organization that people would want to be at. So, yeah. It's a business case. I mean, and you know, my marketing proposal people are sending me stuff all the time to help them get that drafted and that material.
And Krista and Gary, have you noticed that if, and I'm not sure if you've entered into a lot of the either, you know, like subcontracting, being a sub on a larger contract, that as being part of that RFP process, that you've noticed an increase in the number of requests for showing your firm diversity programs?
I have not yet personally seen a lot of that. What we do see is like certain percentages of projects need to have SBE, small business, LBE, local business, WBE, women-owned business, but not necessarily the breakdown of our firm and our programs. I heard that we had one recently that asked for that kind of information, but it hasn't become commonplace. But I would add that internally, tackling the business case or proving to people that it's a, that there is a business case for it is a little harder than helping people to understand that it's an employee retention issue.
Well, okay. Yeah. That's
that seems to hit home a lot faster.
That's the other topic is employee attracting talent and keeping them at the firm. Before we get into that, Gary, have you noticed anything on the RFP side?
Kind of like Krista, no, not so much. DB, you know, that's a big one or whatever, obviously, that we see the most when it comes to minority type businesses. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen anything specifically where they've asked what our structure is or how many people we would have that would be either women or minorities within our firm. But, you know, more and more of the, like if we're going to do a construction staking on a contract, or a lot of times whatever on the RFP, whatever, they'll list like Title VI requirements and EEO, those types of things. They want to make sure that we're an equal employment opportunity company that is trying to fill those positions, but they're not asking for a breakdown on how many people that we have on the, in the company that are either, you know, women or minorities. So.
Yeah. And to the point that Krista raised about employee retention and attracting talent. I mean, Krista, you mentioned that some of the younger engineers at the firm, you know, you see them outside of having conversations in webinars and different engagements, but maybe not bringing up at the firm specifically. I mean, how have you noticed the younger cohort of engineers or people who are looking to join the firm are very interested in the inclusivity and or the inclusion and the diversity aspect of the firm or any programs that you have? Is that a key driver of attracting talent?
I would say yes. I mean, you know, we have a new mentorship program that we launched in support of our younger staff, but all of our staff really, but the current generations are really looking for feedback and for engagement. And, you know, they want to be a part of something. And if they don't see themselves fitting in and being a part of this organization, they move out. You know, we're just seeing a lot less of this, well, this is where I work. And so this is where I stay. That behavior is becoming less common.
Yeah.
And I would also say that the talent pool is much more diverse now than it was previously. Like every year, it just seems to get more and more diverse. And so with that, our firm is looking more diverse. And so we're looking at that going, how do we keep that? You know, how do we keep these people in the industry, not just at our firm, but in the industry?
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's youth or if it's just 2020, but the current generations are definitely less tolerant. Mm-hmm. And wanting more engagement, and yeah. So we have to answer that call, or they won't stick around.
And I would imagine that's, you know, the diversity we always talk about. Of course, you know, it's not just race, gender, but it's also geographic diversity, and also where people went to school, or having that greater breadth of experience from an educational perspective, which is something that we talk about a lot. You know, have your firms done a lot to kind of look at expanding the talent pool beyond your traditional hiring areas, your strong geographic hiring areas?
Yes.
Yeah.
The consultant that we used for our strategic planning process actually provided us with a nice list of colleges that we should be doing outreach to, and, you know, some other organizations that, you know, we should be present in.
So yeah.
We're working on putting that program together and doing that outreach. You've got to have people, though. Like, we want to go to the career fair. Well, we've got to have technical people sitting in front, you know, of the screen or a table that you know, can talk about the technical work and the opportunities at the firm. So we're rounding those folks up and asking them to, you know, help us do that outreach.
And it's probably easier said than done in some areas or whatever. I mean,
that's true.
Living in California, whatever, it's a lot easier to recruit people. Mm-hmm. You know, we're in North Dakota, and right now, if I look outside the window, it's 3 below today.
Yeah.
So
It's not a one size fits all kind of situation, right? I mean, it is geographically dependent.
But COVID has changed so much of that too, Jeff. We're consultants and we're in hydropower. I've got 8-10 offices in the United States, 2 in Canada, and I don't know that we'll ever go back fully to offices.
Well, it's kind of a little bit outside of the focus here, but let me toss that into the questions, on that virtual space. I mean, and it's not a one size fits all kind of thing as well, right? I mean, not all work translates to virtual. You're always going to have to need people at project sites.
Right.
But, have you considered that virtual option for jobs that wouldn't require direct day-to-day client interaction or job site interaction? Mm-hmm. Or is that something which is another conversation, which is more of a down the line kind of thing?
We're looking for the best people who want to do cool work like we do and, be in for the long haul and be able to grow and develop themselves and contribute, greatly to the success and share in that success. So the expanded area, there is no like region anymore, We have people traveling to sites, regardless of where they're home working or not. So it's a whole new world out there as far as, trying to think geographically. You don't necessarily have to do that anymore. Yes, there's people that have to be able to travel and get on the ground with a project. But otherwise, it's really working. I mean, we have employees and, probably 10 more states than we're actually had physical offices before all this. So I don't know, we need to really be very open about how this works, because this is what people will want and this is how we're going to be able to find the talent we need.
And Krista, have you noticed that at all?
Yeah, I'd say we're hesitant. We're struggling with this in the sense that we've seen that it is working virtual, mm-hmm. but we also recognize that it's working when everybody's working from home.
Yeah.
And so we are starting to wonder, two main things come to mind. One, how does this affect the development and growth of our people, right? Because mm-hmm. there's so much incidental conversation that happens when you're just walking around the office or talking to the president at the water cooler, right? Yeah. His door's open, you can walk in. That's different than saying, can I call you? Can I have a video call? I need FaceTime with you. You're just missing that. So mm-hmm. are people going to lack development? Are they going to grow slower? Yeah. Is it going to hamper? And then what if we have some people in and some people out outside of the office? Now, all of a sudden, has there become a division because not everybody's on the same platform? Some people are in person, some people are virtual. The people that are virtual might get left out of conversations. Mm-hmm. I used to experience that just from traveling. I was in LA 3 days a week for 4 years, and I'd have a project with a team in a different office, and they'd have meetings without me. And I'm like, that's not going to work. So what happens when we have half of the people in and half the people out? So
we've been recording a lot of meetings so that if people are, otherwise conflicted, that they can go back and listen. So that's one way we've addressed that part.
Mm, I like that.
So going through the modules, I mean, it's really something, because the first module was creating a culture of engagement and respect. Module 2 is minimizing the impacts of unconscious bias, which we've discussed. Module 3, strengthening multi-generational teams, and module 4, bystander intervention. The multi-generational teams is interesting, because that, I think, goes to Krista, your earlier point as well about, that first project team that you pitched and you had the people who were there the longest. What was your big takeaway from that module, if I could kind of ask the group about mixing the experience levels within a client team?
I'll say that module was a huge eye-opener for me. Mm-hmm. I hadn't never even spent any time thinking about generational biases or differences. And then during the course of that module and learning and discussions, I was like, oh yeah, I see it now. I see it. And it just really made me understand it better. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that we're starting to pay attention to. You know, we have people with 40 years experience, people with half a year experience, and how do we get that transfer of knowledge internally, building project teams specifically internally with a cross section of people, and also chasing projects so that our clients can see that full spectrum too.
Mm-hmm. Susan?
Well, you know, this is hard, these younger people are smarter than we were at that age. They've had the internet. They didn't have to go to the library and dig out through the old encyclopedia, right?
Yeah.
These people are smart, they're worldly, they're talented, they've got technology. And you know, so they're ready. Some of them are more ready now to be put on that project team as you know, maybe a different level or a circumstance or a, you know, experience they haven't had just yet. You know, we have to talk ourselves into it a lot of times, but we're not holding anybody back. Mm-hmm. If people want to go and they want to try, and they want to be part of something that maybe we organizationally might not, oh, geez, you know, they've only been here two years. That's like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, we got to give them a chance,
mm-hmm.
and we've got to give them a soft landing, because the willingness to take on things that you're not 100% mm-hmm. sure about is a really good, you know, characteristic in people. They're willing to take some risk and to be innovative and not worry that if they mess up, they're going to get fired.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they mess up, we're going to learn from it and they'll learn from it. And that's those lessons you just can't, you know, fabricate.
Gary?
Yeah, I think there's a delicate balance there. I guess I agree with Susan. You definitely need to be able to empower people to go out and work. You know, that's probably one of the new words that you hear from all the young people. And we're talking about generations. They like to feel empowered. So mm-hmm. you got to do that so that you're not holding them back in any way. And you have to give them enough rope so they can either prove themselves are going to sink or swim. You have to be ready to be able to bail them out, so to speak.
Yeah.
When you're talking about generational teams, I think that becomes important to have all players involved, because just like Krista was talking about earlier, you have to have some senior people in there to be able to provide that mentorship. You know, mm-hmm. somebody's got to be able to train and mentor those young people. Mm-hmm. And you have to be close enough, not too mm-hmm. far away. You have to be at arm's reach enough to be able to see when maybe the team's getting in trouble. You got to go in there and help them out. So, you know, it's a balancing act to make mm-hmm. sure that you're getting the people that are younger at the organization the opportunities to be able to go out there and prove themselves.
So we covered a lot of the aspects of the course and its importance really to our members. I do actually have one final question before we wrap up. And I'll direct this to Krista and Gary. You know, if someone is out there thinking, should I take this course? Should I invest the time? Having gone through it and learning the things that you have and kind of broadening your horizons a bit on this subject, you know, what would you tell them, you know, to whether to sign up or not?
I would say yes. I've already recommended it to folks. So that's an easy answer.
Easy answer.
I think it just really challenged my thinking. And I was already thinking about these topics, spending a lot of time thinking about it. And it challenged me. And I thought that was fabulous. And it opened up communication and conversations that I didn't expect. It was really positive.
And Gary?
I think education of any sort is always good on any level. And for this one, it was really an eye-opener for me, mostly, as I mentioned before, on the unconscious bias piece. Just sometimes things you say, even things we say in the Midwest, that just kind of part of your language that you maybe don't realize could be perceived by somebody as offensive or discriminatory is too harsh of a word, but it's just a matter of awareness. So I think any of these types of courses you can participate in just for some awareness, whatever, is always good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, did you know, cover quite a bit on females, not so much on minorities. So, you know, it'd be good to have a little bit more focus on that on the next course that they do. But by all means, I think it was a good opportunity to start the discussion.
Yeah, it's interesting to try to figure out the best approach to start getting into the conversation and building it over time. And again, you know, this is something which is a strategic focus that we have in our new plan. And that is, you know, we're implementing against it and we're going to develop this over time. And you were really kind of the first representative of the first group of this course and the first ever course that we've done like this. So your input's going to help shape the courses down the line as well, which is very important. And really appreciate your participating in the class and taking the time out of your day today to talk about it. So Krista, Gary, Susan, thank you so much for being part of the show today and staying engaged. It's really important.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Best of success with continuing to grow the program.
Thank you. And once again, this has been Engineering Influence, a podcast from the American Council of Engineering Companies. We'll see you next time.